You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. We'll be doing some injury updates and talking about Travis Snyder and Zach Britton. We talk Baltimore Orioles with Brittany Giroli. Talking Boston Red Sox with Ian Brown, taking a look at Clay Buchholz, Rick Porcello and his contract, Koji Uehara in the ninth inning. Talking Yankees with Brian Hoke, talking a lot of Masahiro Tanaka, because that's what you talk when you talk Yankees these days, as well as a look at the back of the bullpen. Looking at the injury situation, the offense, and the rotation, talking Rays with Bill Chastain, and talking Toronto Blue Jays with Gregor Chisholm. We'll take a look at Michael Saunders, Edwin Encarnacion's hot start, and the impressive rookie Devin Travis. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. Brett, it was a pretty good start to the season for the Orioles. 2-1 is better than 1-2 or 0-3. Broadly, what did we learn from the first series?
Well, not a whole lot. I mean, you know how it goes. Three games, people want to try and overanalyze, and really it's such a small fraction of the season. I think they were happy to take 2-3 from Tampa. They wanted to win every game, as Buck said last night, but you know, they played well. They pitched fairly well, and I think that they're pretty satisfied with that. So I don't know if you could start looking and analyzing how guys are doing up and down the lineup. Again, it's such a small sample size. I hate to do it. I think overall they're healthy. They're headed back to Baltimore for the first time since probably, you know, early February or so. So they were excited for that last night, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really one of the things is I think that, one of those old sayings that, you know, they say a team that has a good spring training record is going to have a good AAA team. The other thing you hear is, the way you win spring training is to get through it healthy. And the O's didn't get through it completely healthy, but they're in pretty good shape, aren't they? I mean, the Wieters situation we kind of knew was coming, but basically they're in pretty good shape health-wise, aren't they?
Yeah, I think getting back to AJ Hardy will obviously be huge. It just allows them to do a lot more things flexibility-wise if you have a guy as versatile as Ryan Flaherty on the bench instead of playing every day. They'd like to get back to having an extra guy on the bench. Right now they have 13 pitchers. But I think healthy in terms of what could have happened, of course. I think you'll take it any day of the week. And they feel like Wieters isn't too far off. So they're pretty happy with where they are health-wise.
What is the latest with Wieters? That's been kind of an odd situation. Everything was going really well, and then suddenly things weren't going well. But it still seems like nobody's all that concerned. Where is he at right now?
Like, well, he's been throwing for about a week every other day playing catch. So that's certainly a good sign. They feel like they'll continue to kind of back him up. He said intensity-wise, he's throwing at a pretty good intensity. The only difference is they just have to continue to move those distances. So May 1st was a date that had kind of been thrown out there. He said yesterday he's not holding himself to any target date. So I think it'll be after May 1st, but within that month for sure.
What's the plan going to be as far as building him up? Because there really are two different things. And the guy never really got a full spring training as far as at bats, and then you're dealing with the rehab and the elbow and getting the arm where it needs to be, but there's also this need to get this guy to game speed just as far as facing pitching.
Right. I think probably about 2 weeks is what you would see him do in terms of getting at bats and rehab and stuff. He didn't play in any games, as you pointed out, just that one, and then was sidelined with tendonitis, but he did do pretty much everything else. He caught a lot of bullpens. He was doing his conditioning. He was still taking, you know, the part in the infield and the relay drills and things like that. So I think about 2 weeks probably once he progresses enough to get into games.
And then what's the status with J.J. Hardy? You mentioned that's another, you know, significant guy they're doing without and another guy that's really kind of hard to cover for, even though they do have some pieces there.
Yeah, that should be a lot sooner. They're hoping probably Tuesday or Wednesday to send him out on a rehab assignment. He's dealing with a left shoulder strain. He was shut down for a little while. And, you know, with Hardy, he played most of the spring, so it's different from Wieters. I would think, you know, within that week, he would be eligible to come back and to play for them. And he just adds so much to that infield. They're able to do a lot more things, and he's a big leader for them. So I think they're pretty optimistic and won't be too much longer on him.
You kind of touched on this, but, you know, Buck Showalter does – he does kind of like to have some of those versatile players and like to kind of have some pieces and pull some levers. To what extent, not just Hardy's presence in itself, who's a really valuable guy. But as you noted, shortening that bench and kind of to what extent does that kind of hamstring them, not only not having Hardy, but taking Flaherty out of or Cabrera, whichever guy is playing shortstop, out of that mix of sort of being able to be plugged in a lot of places?
Well, it definitely changes the complexion of what they're able to do. And as I mentioned earlier, the fact that they've got one guy less on the bench than they would like to have, ideally, you know, they want to keep Rule 5 pitcher Jason Garcia. So they don't have a whole lot of moves that they can make, and that, to me, is probably Buck's MO. So that's something that they're going to try to fix, whether it's trading a reliever so that they can have a more optionable bullpen. Getting back Hardy should help a whole lot there. And they really want to go back to having 12 pitchers. I mean, having 13 pitchers in the American League East certainly isn't ideal. It prevents you from making a lot of late-game moves. Buck said the other night when they put some defensive replacements in, if they were to have an injury, you know, in the ninth inning, they would have been in big trouble. So that's something they're going to look to correct here very soon.
They got back. There's only one game. It's funny. It seems in some ways like forever, and yet it's only been a few days since Chris Davis was playing in competitive games before the end of his suspension. But how did he come out of spring looking as far as his swing, as far as his timing? How does he look, not just these two games, but just kind of as we start building towards the full grind of the regular season?
I think he looks okay. You know, it's kind of anticlimactic because he played all spring. He didn't feel like he was gone for so long, whereas last year he missed the whole postseason. So that was a little unusual. I do think that Buck's probably going to do what he did his first series a lot, which is rotate Steve Pierce and Chris Davis at first base. You might see either one of those guys in right field. Though Travis Snyder played so well this series, I don't know how much that changes things. I do think Chris Davis is motivated to kind of get back to where he was. He was hurt last year early on. I think that affected him for a while at the plate, and then, of course, suspension. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting year for him, and I think that there's a lot of motivation there also because he's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. So I expect he's going to have a pretty good year. Now, is it going to be 2013? No. But I don't think it's as bad as last year. I think the real Chris Davis is somewhere in the middle.
You mentioned Travis Snyder. I think he's a really interesting guy. He's only 27. He's been around forever. It seems like he should be older than 27, but he's only 27. He's a guy who has shown a lot of different skills, an ability to take a walk, an ability to hit the ball out of the park, shown a little bit of a defensive ability, though he's not a Gold Glover, but he's certainly shown some ability to at least handle himself. And with the history that Dan Duquette has of those finds, those non-obvious finds, do you think that I guess what I'm asking is there some thought in the organization that they may have a real gem on their hands here, a guy who maybe is more than he's shown at times through the first part of his big league career?
Sure. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why they got him. I think you always hope that when you acquire guys who have had some success and also some struggles, that they could turn it around in this new organization. And I think he obviously had a really good opening series, but it's way too early to be saying, you know, Travis Snyder is going to be a guy that they can rely on all year. I mean, he's not going to keep up the pace that he had from these first three games. Yeah, it's impossible. But I do think when you look at his numbers, and I think Marquez's numbers, who he's essentially replaced in right field, they're very similar players. They had very similar stat lines last year. Travis Snyder is younger, doesn't have the health concerns they have with Marquez. So I think when you look at it from that perspective, it was definitely a solid move. He seems to have fit in with this team, with this clubhouse. And it seems like the light has gone on for him because, honestly, he looked horrible, I thought, for most of spring training. The last week or two, he seemed to kind of have stepped it up, and Buck mentioned the same thing the other day, that he thought the last week or two, Snyder finally came into his own, because early on, he was not impressive, and you know, myself and a bunch of the members of the media were kind of wondering what was going to be the deal with this guy.
And one other guy that I kind of want to use a couple of games as a jumping-off point, not suggesting that he's going to average 2.5 strikeouts an inning and not walk anybody all year, but looking at Zach Britton, he's a guy who the last couple years has, you know, I think quite a few things gone right, but one of the things that really stands out, you look at his line, is he really cut the walks back, particularly last year, from 2012 to 2014. He cut his walk rate almost in half. to really be an elite guy, I think you need to cut it even a little more to be an elite ninth inning guy. Do you think he has that in him? Do you see the indications that maybe there's one more step forward in control for him to where he can go from a guy with pretty good control to a guy with the kind of control that you need to really be an elite late inning guy?
I do. You know, he's really, as you mentioned, stepped it up in terms of his stuff. And you just talk to guys who have faced him in the past, and you know, even talking to some of the Rays, he's a completely different pitcher than he was in 2012. You know, what he's able to do, the movement he gets, the swings the opposing hitters take, he's completely overpowering. And he did it all spring. And, you know, Buck asked us to not write it, but Buck said he never had had a closer who was as dominant as Zach Britton was in spring training. And, of course, the worry there was that he was going to have this phenomenal spring training and then come into the season and look awful. And you saw in Tampa that that's just not the case. I mean, the guy just has a ridiculous amount of movement on that fastball, and he lives off of it. He barely needs to throw anything else. So I think as he adapts, last season was his first season as a closer. He wasn't even the closer of the Orioles a year ago. It was a job that he took over when they moved Tommy Hunter out of it in May. So I think he's still got a huge, huge ceiling here to really be, as you mentioned, among the elite closers.
All right. Well, Brittany Tiroli, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter, Brian Hope. Brian, it wouldn't be the Yankees if there weren't some story that we are revisiting every single day and blowing out of proportion and looking at it from 100 different perspectives. And I think some of us were expecting it might be the designated hitter, but instead it appears to be the number one starter right now. I'm still a little perplexed even after reading and editing the story. There was some miscommunication as far as Yankees and Masahiro Tanaka and what he's throwing and his velocity. Can you shed a little light on what exactly the misunderstanding was there?
First of all, I don't know what you're talking about. We don't run anything into the ground on the Yankee beat. I don't know what you're trying to say. No, I'm just kidding. With Tanaka, let me boil it down to this. In spring training down in Tampa, Tanaka spoke to the media and volunteered that he was not going to throw his four-seam fastball quite as much, and he said, for that reason, you're going to see my radar gun readings dip a little bit. And I was there that day. It was strange because it was an unsolicited question. The question was something much more benign than that. And Tanaka volunteered that, came through the translator, and you always have to kind of take everything with a grain of salt here because it's not exactly Tanaka's words. It's Tanaka's words through another party back to English, and that's what we're reading here. But that's the way we can do it because my Japanese is terrible. So Tanaka volunteered.
Don't sell yourself short.
you're a tremendous slouch. That happened. His next start, true to his word, more two-seamers. That was a start in Fort Myers where the Twins hit him around a little bit. Now we fast forward to opening day at the stadium, and that's where with the pitch FX shows that Tanaka indeed did stay away from the four-seamer, but he also stayed away from the two-seamer. That's the thing. He was throwing much fewer fastballs than he did at any point last year. Of the 82 pitches, I believe only 27 were fastballs. So he was really relying on his off-speed a lot against the Blue Jays, and they hit him around the second time through the order. They put up 5 runs against him in the third inning. The start did not go well. It did not go the way the Yankees thought it would. That was not the Tanaka you saw in the first half last year. So I think that's where the confusion comes in. It's okay if he's staying away from the four-seamer, but now is he afraid to throw fastballs altogether? Is he now going to try and just be an east-west, dot-the-corners, Mike Mussina-type pitcher at the end of his career? Or can he still have it in there? Is this a conscious decision? Is the guy who dominated the American League in April, May, and June last year, is he still in there? I think that's the question we all are wondering, and clearly the Yankees are too.
So, in light of all this, it's kind of interesting to revisit those Pedro Martinez comments from a week or so ago, where there was grave offense that Pedro dared to suggest that maybe this guy wasn't at full bore. Now, Pedro suggested it was because he was hurt, but it does seem like maybe Pedro wasn't as off his rocker as some people sort of reacted to it.
Possibly, but I hesitate to read so much into one start, and that's why I think when Tanaka goes up against Boston this Sunday night on ESPN at 8:05, it's going to be a huge test. I'm very curious to see how he bounces back from that. The Yankees believe he's not hurt. The point that they continue to make is guys don't snap off 87-mile-an-hour nasty splitters down in the zone if they're hurt, if they can't pitch. So for that reason, I think that Tanaka is healthy. For whatever reason, he's staying away from the four-seam fastball and from throwing the heat. And I think that's going to create an issue because, as a few people have said, what he does with that fastball is he uses that up in the zone, then he gets people to chase that terrific splitter down the zone, which is one of the best in the league. And even the Blue Jays said, that pitch is not hittable. But you can kind of narrow it down, and if you know he's not coming up, you can look down. So I'm really curious to see how Boston handles him. I'm curious to see how he bounces back here. But I think that if the Yankees thought he could not win games, he wouldn't be on the mound right now. You can't ignore what happened last July, but through the first 4 or 5 weeks of spring training, I feel like we said it a lot. There were no indications that anything was wrong. He pitched against the Braves at Disney World and looked dominant. It was just the last start or two of Grapefruit League that you kind of started to say, something might be up here, but I'm not sure. So I think you're saying the same thing against that start against Toronto, and now Boston is a huge test for him.
I guess the interesting question then is, even if he feels fine, if he doesn't feel anything amiss, he's telling the trainers he doesn't feel anything amiss, he really doesn't feel anything amiss, even so, if he, as you say, is limiting what he's willing to do, if there are places he thinks he shouldn't go, does that inherently mean that to some degree he's automatically preventing himself from being that guy we saw, the guy we know he can be?
Possible. I think the biggest thing is you can't pitch scared. And that's one thing that people were looking at in spring training and saying, is he hesitant? Is he holding anything back? And the Yankees consistently said that no, he wasn't. But go watch that game tape of opening day. It certainly looks like a guy who's holding something back and spinning a bunch of sliders up there and really relying on his off-speed pitches more. And look, he's always gotten a lot of outs with his off-speed pitches. He did that last year. But I think the main thing you're looking at is this guy afraid to rear back and throw his fastball because he thinks his elbow might snap at any point? And look, it's certainly possible. Nobody has ruled that out. But he went to four different doctors. They all recommended rehab. So rehab he did, and he's on the mound. He's made three starts following that tear, and I assume Sunday will be four. So I'm really curious to see how it all works out.
So while we're on the topic of Yankee pitchers that everybody's worrying about, how did Dellin Betances look to you?
I think that it was a continuation of what was his problem in spring training. The one encouraging thing is on a cold and raw, rainy night at Yankee Stadium, he's popping 95, 96 miles an hour. So I think we can put that story to bed with Betances doesn't have his velocity from last year. And Girardi even mentioned yesterday that they went back and they looked at his pitch readings because they were buying into that too. They said, is there something up here? And they went back and looked, and Betances was actually throwing harder this spring than he did last spring. So I'm not concerned about that. I think that what I would look at is, now, do you bring a guy who you think is going to be your closer into a game where you're trailing 2-1 in the eighth inning? That telegraphs to me that Betances is not the closer, and Andrew Miller did a good job locking that game down. I think that if Betances had a fantastic spring and it struck out the world, it would have been the easiest thing for Girardi to do and just say, all right, well, he was great as a setup man last year. He's going to be our closer, and Miller's going to have the eighth. I think that the fact that Betances struggled so much, it kind of pushed the Yankees into this mode of saying lefty, righty, we'll go based upon where the lineup is. Betances and Miller will share the role. So I think that if Dellin had a better spring, we might be looking at a different situation here. But as we've been saying since the day that Miller signed, it's kind of a coin flip. And as you saw last night, look, Andrew Miller came in, did a fine job, 1-2-3 in the ninth. I think that there's no wrong answer here, but I think Dellin Betances had an opportunity to be the Yankees' closer in spring training, and now because he didn't step up and seize that, the Yankees have two closers.
Is it fair to say still, even now, that Joe Girardi is not exactly he's not exactly a Fangraphs or baseball prospectus writer, and that ultimately he would like for one of these guys to seize it, and by May 1st or June 1st or the All-Star break or at some point, he would like to have a ninth-inning guy and an eighth-inning guy?
I think so. I think he said pretty consistently that guys like to know their roles. And it's one thing, for example, Betances said that bullpen coach Gary Tuft told him, be ready for the middle of the order. When Bautista comes up, that's going to be your guy. So just be ready for that. So you can kind of see ahead and where the game is going. And then if Bautista's going to be in the ninth or eighth, and at some point it became clear he was going to come up in the eighth, so Dylan knew to be ready for that. But Girardi has said pretty consistently, guys like to know their roles. I think that he's probably more in tune with some of those fan graph stuff that you mentioned than other managers, but at the same time, just a guy who had Mariano Rivera in his bullpen. It's a very nice luxury to know that's your ninth inning guy. And Dave Robertson was that guy last year. I think that Girardi likes playing the matchups. It's something he does anyway pretty consistently pregame, but if you can have a ninth inning guy, I think that's a luxury he wants to have.
By the way, to be clear, I do not cite those publications pejoratively. I see the things very much the same way. I would love to see Joe Girardi get creative and not have a designated guy. I just don't expect him to do it. One last thing. Carlos Beltran didn't really hit last year. I know he was hurt, but he didn't really hit last year when he played. He didn't really hit in the spring. And in the least valuable by far piece of information that I'm citing here, he hasn't hit through two games. I know we're not officially worried yet, but he's 38. How long till we do worry that maybe Carlos Beltran's just not going to be the guy that he used to be?
Three games, I guess, right? No. Look, I mean, he's a veteran. I think you allow for the fact that he gets off to a slow start. Look, the Yankees haven't hit a whole lot through the first two games. I think that, I know they're 1-1, but that was the flukiest of fluke rallies in the eighth inning in game two. So I think there's certainly time. This weather has not been conducive to hitting. I'm not trying to make excuses for Beltran. He didn't look great this spring. I think it's still in there. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. I think that if he can be somewhere between what he was last year, which was not clearly disappointing, that's not what the Yankees were paying $15 million for. If he's somewhere between what he was last year for the Yankees and what he was his final year in St. Louis, the Yankees would sign up for that in a heartbeat, I think. So really the key is keeping him on the field, being able to play right field. There's been no issues with his elbow, and I think the hits are going to come. He's a professional hitter. You're seeing a lot of these guys who have not torn it up. You know, Mark Teixeira hasn't torn it up. A-Rod had a single, but, you know, big whoop-de-doo. it's very early, but I think that when you start getting 50, 100, 150 at-bats, I think that's when we can start to push the panic button a little bit.
All right. Well, I wait eagerly for that opportunity. Brian Hoke, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, we keep talking about it, but he's a pretty essential player for this team. Michael Saunders appears to be getting closer and closer. What's his status, and how soon are we looking at this guy maybe being a realistic possibility for Major League games?
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, it's been positive news pretty much throughout this entire situation for him ever since he went under the knife, and it looks like there's a chance that he might be ready for the Blue Jays home opener on April 13th. He's started a rehab assignment, and that's obviously a big move for him. He was, prior to that, able to appear in some games on the minor league side as a DH during spring training. He didn't run the bases, didn't play the field, but that should help speed up this process because one of the things that usually takes the longest is trying to get your timing down at the plate. So he's a little bit ahead of the game in terms of that, but what he still needs to do before he can actually get clearance to come up to the big leagues again is just prove that he's able to run without any kind of limitations, that he's going to be able to play left field totally fine. So it could be as early as April 13th, but even if it's not then, I wouldn't expect it to be much longer than that at all, maybe a couple more days.
That would be an awfully big boost. I mean, how big a part was he supposed to be of what they're doing? I mean, I get the feeling he's not a name guy, but it just seems like he's a really essential fit and for what they have offensively, a real need, really addresses something that they needed and fills a hole of something that they didn't really have.
Yeah, I think he's a really underrated piece. When you look at all the moves the Jays made this offseason, he's probably one that went under the radar a little bit, but he really goes a long way in helping to lengthen out that lineup. I mean, you put him in the sixth spot behind the core of that lineup, and you know, the Blue Jays don't have a lot of power from the left side. They obviously have lots from the right when you're talking about you know, 2 through 5 with guys like Russell Martin, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, Josh Donaldson. But the left side is something that they really lack. I think they're hoping that Justin Smoke will give them a little something like that, but he's not nearly as proven of a hitter over the last several years as Michael Saunders is. And they really, the only other lefty on top of that, you go with the switch hitting Jose Reyes. So he gives the Blue Jays a different look. I also think that they really like the defense that he brings in left field. He might not be as good of an overall hitter as Melky Cabrera, but he provides a lot better defense and a lot more range in left field. And the outfield defense has been a concern for the Blue Jays for the past several years, so he helps shore that up as well.
Now let's play a little massively overreact to absurdly tiny sample sizes. Edwin Encarnacion has been a guy who at times has not started well. Through all of 2 games, he has started well this year. Is it a surprise at all, given the challenges he had in spring training? And what could this mean if he is able to put it together for 6 months instead of 4?
Yeah, it would be a huge component of this lineup. There's no question about it. I mean, he had a great year last year when he was healthy, with the exception of that, you know, month that he missed with the quad injury. But when you look at the April that he had last year, it was really, really poor, and a lot of people were wondering whether or not he'd be able to turn it around. You know, he didn't hit his first home run in April until, I think it was around like April 22nd or something like that. He finished that month with just 2 home runs. You know, when it comes to Encarnacion, the one thing that he always talks about is his timing. And, you know, a lot of other hitters would be in the same boat as that. But he's a guy who really goes through the ebbs and flows with that. He's a streaky hitter, and when he can get things zeroed in at the plate, that usually means really good things. And the fact that it's happened this quickly, especially after missing a significant period of time in spring training, you'd think that this would be the year that he would start off slow. But he was able to get into some games in that final week in spring training, and that proved to, so far, to be enough for him to get comfortable in the box. And, you know, he's a guy who, you know, I think a lot of more people talk about Bautista or maybe Donaldson in this lineup. He's a guy who probably has the most power of any of those guys right now. And if he can get going from day one and carry that through a large portion of the regular season, it makes that core of the lineup even a little bit more scary than it was originally.
And one more massive overreaction. A month ago, it didn't look at all like Devin Travis was even going to be on the roster, never mind playing regularly. And now he's certainly done a few nice things in his first taste of big league regular season. First of all, what are you seeing from him at the plate? I mean, he seems like, for his youth, a pretty polished offensive player.
Yeah, and the thing that, you know, he got a lot of attention, obviously, for the home run as his first major league hit on opening day, and that was a great storyline for everyone involved. But what impressed me the most about his game that day, and really the second game as well, was his patience at the plate. I mean, we've seen it many, many times where rookies come up to the big leagues and they press and they feel the need to expand the strike zone, and they're swinging at almost anything close because they want to make a good impression. They just try a little bit too hard. Travis showed that he can, you know, you could tell he was nervous when he got named to the team, and you could tell he was nervous earlier in the day on opening day. But when the game actually started, he was able to calm all that and become a pretty relaxed guy throughout that game. And I think that showed in the 2 walks that he had on opening day, which I think is a big, big bonus because, you know, hitting at the bottom of that order, he's got to have a decent on-base percentage so he can help turn the lineup around. I mean, that's the one question mark in this lineup is probably the final 3 hitters in the order. If those guys can turn the lineup around to the top of the order enough, I mean, this lineup is going to be very, very potent. So to me, it was really the patience that he showed that really kind of gives the Blue Jays, I think, a lot of hope that he will be up here to stay and not just as a temporary fill-in until some of their injured guys get back.
And, I mean, I think the offense, how good he's been offensively may be a bit of a surprise, but the fact that he has shown some ability offensively is not a surprise. The issue seemed to be they weren't entirely sure he'd be ready defensively. What has he shown, again, 2 games, I realize it's hard to say, what has he shown on the defensive side?
He's been solid, and I think that's just what the Blue Jays are kind of hoping for. They know he's not a Gold Glove caliber defender, but there haven't been really any issues with him yet. And I think the big test is still going to come when he goes on the AstroTurf at Rogers Center and see how he reacts to a faster playing surface. But so far on natural grass and spring training and here at Yankee Stadium, he's been just fine. And I think that's exactly what the Jays are looking for. I think the one major adjustment that he has to make is the Blue Jays like to do a lot of shifts on the defensive side. And when he's shifting here in Toronto, he's often in shallow right field, and that's a bit more of a test for his arm. It's something that he's not used to doing as well. He's never really shifted into that shallow right field and kind of played at a position like that. So it's something he's still adjusting to. But on opening day, you know, he got tested on that. There was a ground ball into shallow right field. He kind of converged with Reyes, and there was almost a little bit of miscommunication. But, you know, he was able to kind of stay relaxed in the moment enough to make the play and then make the strong throw. And I think all of that, those are encouraging signs.
So we've had a happy talk for 8 minutes. We got to go to the other direction for a minute here. We knew the bullpen was a worry. We knew that there were reasons to be concerned. We knew they'd taken out a key body from it. And right now, it's showing itself to be a concern. How big a worry is it, and what can they do?
It has to be a concern. And you know, for as many positive stories as we've seen on you know, the prospects, Miguel Castro and Roberto Osuna, and so far in the regular season, that's carried over. They played well. To me, the most concerning aspect in all of this is Brett Cecil. And Brett Cecil missed a lot of time in spring training because of his shoulder injury. But, you know, when he came in to make his debut in the second game of the season last night, he was in a very tough situation. He came in with the bases loaded. The back-to-back game got away from him. Isn't the biggest issue, in my opinion. The biggest issue is the fact that his velocity was down by quite a bit. He was sitting around 87 miles per hour with his fastball. He topped out at 88. That's kind of a situation that he was dealing with a few years ago as a starter. He seemed to get all that figured out when he went to the bullpen. He was able to get the velocity back up to the low 90s, anywhere from 92 to 94. But if he's going to be 87, 88, that's a big concern. He admitted after the game that he's a couple weeks behind everybody else. So I think the hope is that they'll find a way to kind of settle him in here. And once he gets a little bit more work, that velocity will come up. But he has to be a major, major piece of the bullpen. And if that diminished velocity stays where it's at, that's a huge concern for this team.
And one last thing. You had a very interesting piece, I thought, yesterday about R.A. Dickey. And when he really blew up, what made him different, what made him not like every other knuckleballer was that he threw that power knuckler. He threw a knuckleball with velocity, and it was a unique pitch. It was something nobody had ever seen. And you wrote yesterday about how he's taken a little off of it in hopes of controlling it more. So I guess the main thing I'm wondering is, to what extent is there worry that even if that improves his location, that maybe it takes away some of the sort of top-end effectiveness? Or is it just that at this point he's not going to be that number one anymore, so at least get him throwing strikes?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, too. I don't think anyone really can look at him now as a true ace. I mean, it really goes back to his time with the Mets. In the last couple of years, he's been a solid kind of middle-of-the-rotation guy for Toronto, even though he was the opening day starter two of the past 3 years. That's kind of the way he was. I mean, last year he had a solid year, ERA under four. But, you know, the walks have been a major concern for him. I mean, this is a guy who, when he was with the Mets, was walking under 54 batters a year, and each of the past 2 years in Toronto, he was up over 70. And the amount of free passes with the number of home runs that he can give up really has cost him a lot during his days in Toronto. So what he thinks is taking, you know, the pedal, his foot off the gas pedal a little bit will help enable him to throw more strikes on a consistent basis. He thinks that when he was trying to get the velocity up there into the high 70s and low 80s like he used to do, he was coming out of his mechanics a little bit. And to be honest with you, part of this very well could be the fact that he's continuing to get up there in age. And, you know, normally you think of knuckleballers as kind of the ageless wonders out there because of the pitch that they throw. But since he wasn't a traditional knuckleballer, he was generating a lot more velocity than some of those guys that came before him. So it's probably a little bit more difficult for him to get those speeds that he was used to several years ago as well. So I think this is another way to kind of compensate that. Instead of him stepping on the gas as much as he did before, he'll take a little bit off, probably only 2-3 miles per hour. It's more of a mid-70s knuckleball now as opposed to a high-70s knuckleball. But the goal is for him to try and settle in and find command of that pitch more often than not.
Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter Bill Chastain. Bill, a team that didn't really have a lot of margin for error before the season started and then got some bad injury news in spring training, continues to get bad injury news, losing a couple of bats to the DL in recent days. First, just tell us what exactly is going on with John Jaso and James Loney. What are their statuses, and how long are these guys looking at doing without them?
Well, first we go with Loney, and of course he's been on the DL on Wednesday. He has a mild oblique strain, and they think they got it early. In fact, you know, Loney wasn't sure that he was that badly injured or not, so he should be back fairly quickly. And the same thing really with Jaso. They were just waiting to see, you know, if it was going to linger, and it looks like it's going to linger a little bit. So I guess they're just going to have to. And I won't find out until we get the ballpark today, because they just put him on the DL yesterday, or officially today. But you know, I don't expect either one of them to be long term type injuries. But you know, again, it's just more blows for a team that's struggling to offense anyway.
In the absence of those two guys, who are pretty. Loney's is an everyday guy, and it looks like Jaso was at least intended to be pretty close to an everyday guy. What do they do to fill those two lineup spots? You know, two guys who aren't huge bats, but they both do have some OBP skills, and that's something this team definitely needs.
Well, you know, immediately they brought up Dykstra the other day to take Loney's place. You know, and Mikey Mapai. Tonight is to take Jaso's place, and you know, both of them minor league guys, so you know, I just don't think the expectations can be that great. I mean, their offense is hurting right now, and it's really not getting any better.
All right, is there any solution? Is there anybody on the bench who might get an opportunity? Is there anything they can do, or is it just ride this out for a couple of weeks and hope the pitchers can do enough to keep them above water?
Maybe they could activate their first base coach, Rocco Baldelli. That might help. But, no, I think they're just going to have to hope that they play good defense and find a way to pitch right now to just get them through this really bad patch to start the season. I mean, you know, everybody knew they were going to struggle on offense, but, you know, having offensive injuries and then having their pitching take a licking like it has in the early going, it's you know, trying times for the Rays right now.
On the pitching side, there was some positive development last night, it seems. Drew Smyly got back on a mound in a rehab start. What did you hear about how that went?
I heard it went fine, and, you know, from all indications, he could be back earlier if they decide to bring him back when he was on, like, a 75-pitch pitch limit. That's to be determined, but from all of his outings and bullpen, you know, obviously last night was his first outing in a game, but from all of his bullpen sessions and pitching the live batting practice, he's felt fine afterwards, his shoulder has. So I think they're fairly optimistic about that, and I think we probably could see Colome come back fairly quick as well.
And will Colome go straight into the rotation? Would that be the way they do that? He was a candidate, but they're down enough starters, it seems, that they could probably use him in the rotation.
I'm sorry, who?
When Alex Colome comes back, would he go straight into the rotation?
I would think so.
And how's Alex Cobb doing?
Well, Alex Cobb right now is a little bit stalled. Nothing apparently is serious or anything, but not making progress as, you know, maybe as aggressively as they had hoped. You know, no real setbacks, just not really, you know, at the top right now. So, you know, that could, who knows, the what they're not saying, you know, who knows, it might be a little bit longer than what was initially expected.
So what roughly would that mean? I realize we're talking in vague terms, and nobody really knows till guys, you know, pitching in games and all of that.
The longer he goes from sitting on a mound, you know, the longer it's going to be before he is going to be able to stretch himself out to make a start. So, you know, based on where it is right now, I think, you know, we could be looking early May.
Okay. One good thing we did see from those first few games, the bullpen looked very strong. It's time to play massive overreactions to absolutely tiny sample sizes, but from scouting the box score, it does look like there are reasons to be encouraged about the Rays' bullpen. It looked that way to you from somebody who was there?
Definitely. I think if you can look for one bright spot right now, it has been the bullpen. I mean, just even the way they finished out the other night, you had Jefferson Smith at the three guys in the eighth, and then you had Boxberger finish it out by striking three guys out in the ninth. And both of them did it in somewhat overpowering fashion. So I think that's, you know, something to be very optimistic about. But by the same token, as we all know, you know, if you don't have the starters to get you in deep, that starts wearing on your bullpen really quick. So that's, you know, really why they need to get these starters back pretty quickly, or the bullpen will start taking a toll on the bullpen.
All right, and while we're continuing to play overreact to tiny sample sizes, what just kind of broadly from watching this team for three games, admittedly against a very good Baltimore team, but what do you take from the first time seeing them play games that count, that 1-2 home start?
You know, I think they're doing what you would think they'd be doing for a team that's struggling to have their regular guys on the field. They're looking to find stop gaps right now, and you know, whatever they can do is, you know, just for example, tonight they're starting Steve Gelf, the reliever, because they haven't really explained it to us yet. You know, we all thought it was going to be Erasmo Ramirez or Matt Andrews, who have both started some, but apparently they want to wait and see what Gelf can do at the start of the game, you know, one or two innings, and then bring in one of those guys. And it might be because they want to play some games based on, you know, National League ball, but you know, right now they are scrambling.
I see. You look at how they're setting up the rotation, and they have Archer going on regular rest, going on 4 days, and then sort of shuffling guys around him. Will that sort of be the plan here for the next few weeks? They don't have a lot of off days after this week, but maybe try to maximize with a rotation down some guys to try and get that guy who's pretty clearly the best of the healthy guys to start every 5 days and kind of work around him, or will they maybe not stick to that?
Well, they got the three guys right now. They've got Archer, Carnes, and Odorizzi, and then they're going to have to work around that. And I think it's April 14th. By then, you're going to need a fifth starter. So some things are going to have to come into shape before that. You know, who knows? Maybe they'll get a good look at Andrizzi and Ramirez and decide to go on to put those guys in there. But right now, they're not really tipping their hand. I mean, it wasn't until 10 o'clock last night, so they named Jokic starts tonight. So I'll be interested to hear what they have to say about that.
All right. Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter Ian Brown. Ian, we still continue to not have enough information, and it's still not really answered until the end of the year. But with a regular season start following a strong spring, are you continuing to be more confident that Clay Buchholz is going to be the guy that the Red Sox hope he will be and believe he can be?
Yeah, Matthew. I mean, I think I've told you this from day one this spring. I really have a good feeling about Clay Buchholz right now. He just came into camp looking like a different guy, looking like someone who's ready for more responsibility, looking for somebody who knew that the team was now counting on him more, and sort of embracing that and just not only getting his own house in order, but sort of providing leadership to the rest of the rotation. I think this is really good for him. And, I think that Clay is going to have a good year, provided that, you know, he stays healthy, which is the big if.
As we look back, was he just not healthy last year? Or was it more that he wasn't convinced he was healthy and sort of just not pitching with conviction?
The latter. I mean, he's been very candid. And the beauty with Buchholz is he's not one of those guys who BS's you. I mean, he tells you what he was really thinking. He said he was afraid to let it go last year. And then he lost confidence, you know, as he started to hit around. And Clay's a guy who has a lot of things going on between the ears sometimes. And I think that's what he's trying to be mentally tougher this year and to minimize his adversity. And that's been the problem throughout his career, is that it's kind of like good or bad, things really snowball for Clay Buchholz. When he's pitching well, you know, he's a real streak pitcher. When he's pitching bad, he really goes the other way and starts to have a lot of things going on. So he just needs to be more consistent this year and try not to ride those bad waves enough. The Red Sox will be more than happy if he continues to ride the good waves.
So as much as anything, was it just a matter of getting away for 5 months and coming back and just sort of saying, here, let's let it go?
Not just that, but Clay Buchholz is also always a guy who's needed to have a good offseason to build a good base. And in the offseason following the 2013 season, like many of the Red Sox players, he had a short offseason because of the winning the World Series. That's the one drawback, I guess, if you could call it winning a World Series, that cuts into your offseason. And much like Alan Craig was kind of in the same boat, he just didn't have a chance to sort of build that foundation for himself. And, you know, he didn't throw his first bullpen until spring training in 2014. He had already thrown five or six before he got there. So I think he just had a lot more time last winter to not only build himself back mentally, but, you know, also physically.
Elsewhere in that rotation, just within the last few days, the Red Sox made an enormous financial commitment, at least, to Rick Porcello. Reasonable on the years, considering what some starters get when they go out on the open market. What was the thought process behind doing what I think to a lot of people was a fairly eye-popping deal?
Yeah, I mean, you look at Rick Porcello, he is the first pitcher in Red Sox history who's going to make $20 million a year. And, you know, it's kind of hard to believe when you think, you know, this is a team that had Pedro Martinez and Curt Schilling and John Lester and some of these other, you know, obviously prices have gone up through the years. But I think, you know, what the Red Sox have done, this has been their strategy in recent years, Matthew. They love the shorter deals, and they're willing to go pay more dollars for the shorter deals rather than make the long-term investments. And they love guys who are between 27 and 30. This is, in a nutshell, why they didn't end up keeping John Lester, because he's in his early 30s. They didn't think that, you know, they'd done a lot of research on this, and they don't think it's good investment to pay that much money for a guy in his 30s. But they think that Rick Porcello, they're betting basically that, you know, this contract is for the next 4 years starting next year. They're basically betting that those 4 years at ages 27 through 30 are going to be the best 4 years of his career. And, you know, we'll see if they're right.
Do they think they essentially got a break on the years? I mean, is that kind of how they look at it, that they went high on AAV because maybe it would have taken more years to sign an equivalent guy or to sign him on the open market?
Yeah, the Red Sox did a lot of research on this and saw, you know, who else was going to become available. And, yeah, they really wanted a four-year deal here with Porcello. And, you know, I can't emphasize enough how much John, you know, even John Henry, and not just the front office, but John Henry has a real fear of older players and investing big money in older players. And they love, you know, John Henry's always going to authorize, you know, a higher expense, you know, if it's for a guy in his, you know, his mid-20s, or as you saw in the case of Yohan Moncada, you know, a 19-year-old Cuban. They love, you know, they're more than happy to break the bank sort of on the younger guys, but not so much, you know, on the older guys. They've been burnt too many times in free agency with the veteran guy, you know, in his 30s.
How good do you think the infield defense is behind him? I think there are a couple guys. It's an interesting question. I mean, Napoli has the ability to be a good first baseman. Pedroia, again, you wonder as he ages, but certainly has the capacity to be a good second baseman. Bogarts, I think, is at least capable. I don't know that he's a plus shortstop. I ask because this is a guy who more than nearly anybody leans so heavily on his defense. Do you think this is the kind of defense that – it's certainly better than what he played in front of a lot of the time in Detroit, but do you think this infield is the kind of defense that can really maximize what Rick Porcello offers?
Yeah, for 2015, there's no doubt, because Mike Napoli, probably actually a very underrated first baseman defensively. He's kind of better than a lot of people think there. And Pedroia, you know, from what I've seen already in the first two games, you know, he's as good as ever on defense. He hasn't lost anything on defense at all. Xander Bogarts, he's a big question mark. He was inconsistent defensively last year, looks a little lost at the plate right now, but he did work hard in the offseason to gain some mobility. Right? Did a lot of agility stuff in the offseason, so he's hoping to have a good year short. And Sandoval, for right now, I caution for right now for this season, I think he's fine at third base. You know, you wonder as he ages and has never had the greatest body anyway, but as he ages, you know, how much third base is he still going to be able to play? But I think for this year, yeah, I think that their defense is well positioned to handle this. Not just Porcello, but most of the staff really consists of sinker ballers. So you look at Masterson and Miley, and you know, Joe Kelly's a guy who can keep the ball on the ground sometimes too when he's going well.
And you teed it up perfectly. Can you give me a health update on both Joe Kelly and Koji Uehara? How are those guys doing?
Yeah, I think we're really at a positive place with Joe Kelly. I mean, he really hasn't had any setbacks with that bicep injury he had a couple weeks back. It's just a matter of building back, building up to the pitch count. And, you know, they could have pitched him in New York this weekend, but they figure, you know, it makes more sense to get him out to 95 pitches, like all the starting pitchers did in spring training before they pitched in a game. Koji, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I'm a little concerned about Koji. This is a guy who just turned 40 years old. He had this leg injury a few weeks back in spring training. It seems like he's been kind of slow to recover from it. And the three games he pitched in spring training before the injury, he didn't pitch very well. And this coming off last season. So, you know, I'm not going to feel good about Koji until I see him saving games for the Red Sox again. I do think that you know, he's going to throw a rehab pretty soon here, and he's probably going to throw maybe three or four games in the minor leagues. I think you'll see Koji back with the Red Sox at some point during their first homestand. I think maybe people can finally breathe easy on Koji once they see him start to save games again. But anytime you have a 40-year-old closer, it's going to be concerning until you see him go out there and do it.
Is he going to be handled with any – I mean, I realize they don't exactly run him into the ground anyway, but will there be even any more restrictions on him this year when he comes back than in past years?
Yeah, much like with Shane Victorino, I think the Red Sox feel they can pick their spots a little with Koji because some of the depth they've acquired. You know, you have Alexi Ogando who you can throw out there. Junichi Tozawa, you know, he's a pitcher they really liked for quite a few years, and they're not hesitant to throw him out there. Edward Mojica has closed before, you know. So the Red Sox think they have the bullpen depth so they don't have to run Koji into the ground. So I think you're right. I think they will be careful about that.
In this time, while they are without Uehara, we've talked. It seems like Mojica is likely the guy to get the saves. Is that a flexible plan, or is that pretty set? Is that something where maybe they mix and match some, or is Mojica the guy for as long as Uehara's out?
Yeah, I think Mojica's pretty much the guy as long as he gets out there and demonstrates that he can do the job. I mean, last year he had a really tough start to the season with the Red Sox. He had some neck problems, and he was getting used to the American League. Finished pretty strong and seemed to embrace the challenge last year whenever he got closing opportunities. He was very successful at save situations. So as long as he's throwing the ball well, he's going to be the guy. I mean, if he goes out there and has a few real shaky outings, they might try to mix and match a little bit more, whether it's with an Ogando or a Tozawa or somebody like that.
All right, well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.